This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, if you want to be a national leader in the Democratic Party, that youth coalition will be behind you if you stand up and you fight for the things that they're fighting for.
Back in the 1930s, when the U.S. was in the midst of an economic crisis, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt enacted a set of policies to protect the people of the U.S. from the worst ravages of poverty. It was called the New Deal. Our planet is currently in the midst of an environmental crisis. Some lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are asserting that this crisis requires a set of policies no less deep or sweeping than FDR's New Deal. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to political consultant Aaron Huertas to better understand the ins and outs of the initiative set forth by the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. We take a look at the history behind the idea, delve into some of the policy specifics, and consider how the two major political parties are responding to this Green New Deal. I'm joined once again on Sea Change Radio by Aaron Huertas. He is a political consultant and a science evangelist. Aaron, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me again.
So last time we had you on the show, the Democrats were out of power in the House. That has changed. That's the big change since we've spoken last. And as a DC insider, I wanted to get kind of your first reactions to how the mood has shifted, and then I want to dive into how policy will be affected moving forward, particularly in the environmental space.
Yeah, well, you know, I worked for Swing Left during the midterms, and I served as their strategic communications director, and we were solely focused on getting people to volunteer from blue areas to go to swing districts to help flip those swing districts for Democrats. And the voter turnout that we saw in the midterms was astronomical. It's the best turnout we've had in a midterm in more than 100 years, probably in all time. And that was really driven by this grassroots resistance. And it was driven by people who recognized that they really needed to do more than vote. They needed to help other people vote too, and they needed to volunteer for campaigns. So we won in races that Democrats haven't been competitive in years. And we heard stories from all across the country of Democrats opening up field offices that hadn't been active since 2008, right? No professional staff or volunteers had been there since that big landslide election with Barack Obama. And those same places, those same people, and a lot of new people got active again in a big way as part of a midterm. So that energy is huge, and it was enough to overcome gerrymandering and all these biases and voter suppression that are baked into our system now to sweep Democrats back into office in the House in a big way.
And the Green New Deal. First of all, for our listeners, why don't you outline the history of this and maybe give an elevator pitch to a fellow congressman if you were in Congress?
Historically, the concept of a Green New Deal has been around for a long time, and think tanks have talked about what something like a Green New Deal could look like for many years. And they usually meant it in the context of, you know, could you do something that was similar to the large injection of government backing into the economy like Franklin Roosevelt had during the New Deal, but geared toward green infrastructure and clean energy? And that concept has evolved over the years, and it's really been adopted by the progressive left, by democratic socialists, by people who want to push a Green New Deal that is rooted in justice and fairness and recognizes climate change as a justice-based issue. And one thing that got the Green New Deal on people's radar in a big way was some very smart advocacy by a group called Sunrise Movement, which is a relatively new player in the climate space. It's a youth-led climate movement, and they very smartly started holding sit-ins in congressional offices after the election, but before the new Congress was sworn in. And that's usually a pretty quiet time on the policymaking front, but They really forced the new Democratic majority to take climate change seriously, and they advanced the concept of a Green New Deal in a really big way and in a new way. And of course, they benefited immensely from Congresswoman-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joining their sit-in, talking about how much she supported them and wanted to see a Green New Deal too. And she was one of several candidates who ran on a Green New Deal platform all around the country. And of course, she has a huge megaphone. So that's had a big agenda-setting effect in the climate policy debate. And now the entire climate debate, you know, has really been pushed forward in a big way because of all this advocacy around a Green New Deal.
And is there a white paper out outlining the basic ideas behind the Green New Deal? And if so, maybe you can kind of tell us who's behind it.
Yeah, there's a few Green New Deal proposals out there. So as far as a white paper goes, or think tanks putting something together, or Data for Progress, which is a progressive, very left-leaning think tank, they put some proposals together and polled on them and found people want to see, you know, big infrastructure investments and things like that. The Green New Deal itself, as far as it exists, right now it's a congressional resolution. So that's backed by Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, by Senator Markey, by 60-plus co-sponsors in the House, by 9 co-sponsors in the Senate. And that outlines some principles for what a Green New Deal could look like. And in addition to all of the, you know, big picture infrastructure investments, the switch over to clean energy, they're also talking about improving public health and economic security for everybody, including people who would go through an energy transition. So they're talking about a lot of big picture stuff, and the Green New Deal proposals are going to get more fleshed out over time and get more and more realistic over time. But the Green New Deal concept, it's really quite a lot further than what we've seen with other national policy debates about climate change before. This goes further than the cap and trade debates we saw in the late 2000s, and it goes further than the debates we've had for a while about things like fuel economy standards and renewable electricity standards. This is talking about, you know, war mobilization scale investments in the U.S. economy to get us to 100% clean energy future.
So are you familiar with the technologist and writer Ramez Nam?
Oh, not particularly, but I think I saw his Twitter thread on all this.
I hadn't heard of him either, but he had a terrific thread that really got me thinking about the ins and outs of the Green New Deal. So I'm going to crib a few of his ideas as we move forward with this discussion. He says that an ideal climate policy would A, make a meaningful impact, B, address problems the market isn't addressing itself, C, be cost-effective, and D, be actually passable. Starting with the impact itself, when we think of the green economy, we think of transportation, and we think of electricity and grid issues, and then we kind of stop right there. But as Nam points out, manufacturing and agriculture are accounting for about 45% of global emissions. And that's usually not under the umbrella of what we consider green economics in this country. When we had like Van Jones as the clean energy czar, we weren't talking about redoing the agricultural sector. That was kind of a separate discussion. But it shouldn't be, is what Nam is setting forth. So do you think this is too big a topic for policymakers to take on? When we're talking about transportation, agriculture, manufacturing, I mean, it's pretty much civilization, right?
Yeah, I think it has to be big. And the part of how you count emissions from agriculture also include, and manufacturing also includes, how much electricity they use, how they transport goods. So it is part of the same picture. You know, fundamentally, the fuel that we're burning in cars and in power plants is still the top contributor to climate change, right? And then some of that fuel is burned for different parts of the economy. So part of it is how you slice and dice it. The stuff that's separate within agriculture are things like the impact of land use change, fertilizers, methane from cows that the cows emit, stuff like that. So those are things we can absolutely address too, but it's just important to not conflate those things. Different sectors of the economy are still using a lot of electricity and transportation. So part of it is how you count it. But stepping back a second, the solutions have to be big because we've industrialized the economy in such a huge way since the 1960s. And half of all emissions globally have been after 1960. So it's actually a very recent phenomenon in a lot of ways. So all that infrastructure that we've built up over the past several decades, all that infrastructure is going to be rebuilt and updated over time anyway. And if we don't take a big picture approach, and if we look at things in a very piecemeal way, you're just not going to get the emissions reductions you need to get to net zero. So climate change demands that we think very bigly. And I think that one of the things that the Green New Deal has uncovered is that there is a huge appetite, especially among progressives, for really big solutions that match the scale of the problem. And previous national climate efforts, I think there's been enthusiasm for them. Environmental groups have supported them. There's been grassroots support for them, but maybe not at this scale. This is the most excited I've seen people about climate legislation or climate solutions in a long time. And I think it is because the scale of the solution finally feels like it matches the scale of the problem.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Aaron Huertas. He's a political consultant. So Aaron, Ramez Nam goes on to point out that we often look at a country's climate policy. You know, we can only do so much because an American politician can only focus on America, but they really need to look at global emissions because we're all in this fight together, ultimately, as human beings. And Noah Smith of Bloomberg points out that the U.S. produces only 15% of carbon emissions. And Nam points to Germany having early subsidies for solar and wind being really impactful because it lowered the prices for solar and wind production around the globe. If the U.S. can do this, it could be enormous, something on the scale of what Germany did back then. Why don't you give us some examples of how you could see a template like the German one turbocharged with the size of the U.S. economy if implemented correctly?
Yeah, you know, we saw an explosive growth in wind energy and solar energy in the latter years of the Obama administration and even into these, you know, past years with the Trump administration. And a lot of that stems from investments that we made as part of the Recovery and Reinvestment Act to help us get out of the recession. A lot of economists say that that could have been bigger, but there's a huge spike in spending on energy technology and subsidies for advanced manufacturing in clean energy. One of the things that also happened was that cheap solar panels from China started coming into the U.S. market. So there were a lot of factors happening where we finally hit economies of scale for a lot of these clean energy technologies. And that is absolutely a global phenomenon. And those early investments do pay off in big ways. And I would also say that when you look at, you know, U.S. emissions versus the rest of the world, it's kind of a narrow analysis to say that U.S. emissions are just 15%, right? Like everyone who works on international climate policy is very aware of that. And those disparities among countries are at the heart of global climate negotiations. And for years, those negotiations were stuck with the United States pointing their finger at China and India and saying, we're not going to solve emissions until you solve emissions because your emissions are growing so fast. And China and India and other developing countries saying, hey, you've been polluting for free since 1960. We're not going to give up on development until you promise to reduce your emissions. And the breakthroughs in climate policy, especially at the international level, have happened by reversing that dynamic and instead saying, we're all committed to reducing emissions. Everybody come to the table with your emissions reductions pledges and what you're going to be able to do. And for the developed countries, for the United States, for the European Union, come to the table with assistance for other countries so they can enjoy the same types of development you had, but without the emissions. So Norway was funding massive projects to save forests in the Amazon. We did a lot of technology transfer and clean energy support for China and for India. And those countries have been able to adopt more aggressive climate mitigation policies in part because of those cooperation and because of those agreements. So, you know, I do think at the international climate policymaking level, there are opportunities for agreements like that. But the United States remains an outlier in that we're still one of the very few countries where we have a major political party, in our case, the Republican Party, that is not on board with these climate solutions and is still fighting them.
That's critical. But let's pretend that they don't exist right now. And you are Nancy Pelosi's chief environmental policy advisor. She's been a little skeptical in the news about a Green New Deal. I think it's a little daunting for her in that it's very general. And she has a pretty full plate of things she wants to get done. But she's secretly come to Aaron Huertas and said, give me some things that are going to be the easiest for me and my caucus to pass. And then which are some of the areas that would actually have the most teeth?
Well, you know, it's the politics on this are going to evolve so rapidly. And even just today, Representative Tom Sousey from Long Island, he signed on to the Green New Deal. And that was really significant because he is the vice chair of the Problem Solvers Caucus. And the Problem Solvers Caucus is, yeah, they're a centrist caucus. It's 24 Democrats, it's 24 Republicans. They are always working to find things that they can agree on. And they're totally, you know, embrace incremental change and getting things done in Congress. So, you know, he's not a lefty progressive member of Congress, but he's signed on to the Green New Deal resolution. And for a lot of members, I think it's because they want to be part of this change and they want to be part of this conversation. So I think the ambition for what national level Democrats can endorse or feel comfortable endorsing within the context of a Green New Deal, it's going to keep getting bigger and bigger. So, you know, we've had narrow debates about, you know, could Congress do a mild carbon price as part of budget negotiations? Or a few years ago, Pelosi was able to negotiate tax credits getting extended to the wind and solar industry that they're really reliant on, like these policies in Germany that help the industry grow and achieve these economies of scale. And in exchange, Republicans wanted the United States to be able to export crude oil for the first time. So that wasn't something that environmentalists were particularly happy with. But from Pelosi's perspective, you know, she wasn't happy with these crude oil exports either. But that was the deal that had to be made to get this stuff through Congress and to save these tax credits and to not get a collapse in the wind industry or the solar industry in the United States. So I think the ambition is going to grow. I have always been a huge fan of performance-based standards. So energy efficiency standards, fuel economy standards, renewable electricity standards, they have done more to reduce emissions than any other policy in the United States ever, especially fuel economy standards. And these are policies that stretch back to the 1970s, right? These were energy conservation policies. They weren't climate policies, but they've been great for improving technology and reducing emissions. So we can go further with fuel economy standards. The Trump administration has rolled back some of the Obama-era fuel economy standards, and Congress could intervene and raise the floor for fuel economy in the United States. And that could do a lot to incentivize vehicle electrification, too. We have never had a national renewable electricity standard or a national clean energy standard, which would allow in you know, things like nuclear or hydroelectric or other forms of energy that aren't necessarily renewable but that are zero emissions. And that could be absolutely huge. There are, I think, 29 states plus the District of Columbia have their own state-level renewable electricity standards. So a national standard would, again, keep raising that floor for all the utilities for how much clean energy they should expect to put online in the next 20 to 30 years, because utilities have a very long planning cycle.
So let's say we do get a national policy. Would it clash with the efforts of individual states?
Yeah, that's always been... There's often been competing standards, especially California can set a lot of its own standards under the Clean Air Act. But in the case of a renewable electricity standard, the states that are further out ahead of the national standard already, they're already further out ahead of it. They don't have to worry about it. The big effect that it would have would dramatically reduce the cost of wind and solar energy, because the economies of scale for the clean energy it would drag those prices down pretty quickly. And especially from the perspective of utilities that do these long planning cycles, they're looking at all the new power sources they're going to be bringing online. And if they have to meet these standards and they start, you know, bidding out more contracts for wind turbines, more contracts for solar panels, that switches over that part of the economy to the clean energy side of things. So the states that are behind now would have more catching up to do, but because they're on such long-term planning cycles, they would absolutely have the time to do that. They just need that legislative signal from Congress.
I see my freedom from across the way, and it comes right in one time. When it shines so bright, and it gives so much light, and it comes from the sky above. Make me feel so free, make me feel like me, and it lights my life. And it seems like
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to political consultant Aaron Huertas. So, Aaron, we mentioned how Nancy Pelosi hasn't been touting the Green Deal like some other politicians. For our listeners who aren't familiar with what Pelosi said, let me just quote. She said, "It will be one of several or maybe many suggestions that we receive. The Green Dream or whatever they call it, nobody knows what it is, but they're for it, right?" That kind of was interpreted as some shade thrown at the Green New Deal and probably more specifically Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. What does that mean on the Hill where you are?
Yeah, I feel like it's been difficult for the advocates of the Green New Deal to not take that negatively. But I think realistically over the next 2 years, you know, what is the Democratic-led House going to do on climate? There could be a whole bunch of things. It could be a big Green New Deal. It could be elements of things that go into a Green New Deal. Ocasio-Cortez has said that we should treat the Green New Deal like a request for proposals for ideas for how to reduce emissions and things that Congress can do. And a lot of this, for me, it's such a redux of the same dynamics that we saw during the Waxman-Markey cap-and-trade debates under Obama. And, you know, we just lost John Dingell. John Dingell really treated the climate debate like a request for proposals. And he asked everyone who was interested in climate policy to come to him on the Energy and Commerce Committee and give him all their ideas for how we could reduce emissions as part of those cap-and-trade negotiations. And we called that request a Dingellgram because it was from John Dingell's office. So, you know, members of Congress want to convene these conversations around their frameworks, and the Green New Deal framework is way more ambitious than what we were dealing with under the Obama administration. A lot more could fit into that because you're talking about these massive investments and government-backed investments in a clean energy economy. And from the leadership's perspective, one thing that's really important to understand about how climate policy is formulated in the United States is that it's split among a bunch of different committees. So you have an Energy and Commerce Committee, you have a Science Committee, you have a Natural Resources Committee. We're going to have our second special committee on climate change specifically. And then in the Senate, it's split among a bunch of other different committees that all have different particular jurisdictions. Then the federal government has 13 different agencies that have something to say about climate change. So the structure of government and the power structures that we have, they're not built to tackle climate change. And that's part of the reason that the Sunrise Movement came in with a very specific request to make a committee that would be focused on a Green New Deal. The committee, as it's designed, is focused on the climate crisis writ large. So it has a bigger mandate in a lot of ways. So, you know, I think all of these ideas are going to evolve. I think the political ambition on the Green New Deal is going to keep expanding. And what's really interesting to me is the early polling on a Green New Deal, just conceptually, like not very fleshed out, you have supermajority support in the American public. Now, as that gets more specific, how are people going to react to it? I think that's what everybody's going to be watching out for, because as we saw during the cap and trade debate, you know, the idea of doing something about climate change, it's pretty popular, but once people started mobilizing around the specific policy proposals, the public opinion started changing pretty dramatically too. And members of Congress, you know, had to decide, am I going to be for this thing or am I going to be against this thing? How is it playing in my district? You had a lot of industry groups come in and threaten members of Congress with, you know, negative television ads against them if they voted for the bill. And that hasn't happened yet because we're not having votes on stuff yet. So I think the best way to understand what's happening with the Green New Deal and what's happening on the Hill is to understand that there's going to be a lot of competition for ideas and that the boundaries of what's possible are going to keep expanding. And my hope in particular is that Democrats do embrace really ambitious climate policy because the young people are going to be absolutely with us if we do that. And in the midterms in particular, voters who are 18 to 29 years old, they went for Democrats by about a 2-to-1 margin. And that's not always been true. We kind of assume that young people vote for Democrats, you know, as a matter of course, but that's not true at all. They've voted as a majority for Republican candidates for office at the national level before. This midterm performance among young voters was better than Barack Obama did with young voters in 2008. And this generation, because they prioritize key sets of issues that Democrats are for, like addressing income inequality, addressing the student debt crisis, addressing the climate crisis, fighting racial discrimination and other forms of discrimination, there's an opportunity for that generation to really have a leadership role in the Democratic Party and for those voters to really identify as Democrats for the rest of their lives, because that's a party that has their generational self-interest at heart. And I think the more members of Congress see that and internalize that and see how much young people are doing to step up in our politics and change the political conversations we're having around some of these issues, you know, if you want to be a national leader in the Democratic Party, that youth coalition will be behind you if you stand up and you fight for the things that they're fighting for.
I totally agree. And I think that it's important as we move into the early stages of the Democratic presidential primary to keep in mind that the safe choice isn't necessarily the candidate that's going to appeal to older, white, Rust Belt voters. It's going to be more expanding the pie than wooing people on the fence and people who may have voted for Donald Trump in 2016.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I certainly saw that play out in the midterms, right? If you're engaging a progressive base of voters who are excited to vote for you and telling their friends to go vote for you, you're going to win, and you're going to be able to make up the gap in a lot of these places that are purple or red. And in particular, you know, we have a really fired up resistance movement that is happy to volunteer for candidates and knock doors and make calls and do those things that we know win elections. And I think both of the parties recognize that the way our politics has evolved, the way our media has evolved, that competition over voters in the middle, that's not where you're winning elections anymore. It was maybe in the era of big TV, but now it's more about engaging your base. And in particular, you know, a lot of the folks who are moderate, they're not really moderate in the sense that, like, you know, columnists for the Washington Post might be moderate or something like that. Mm-hmm. Most moderates in American politics, they're polarized. They're just polarized on different issues. So you have voters out there who are passionate about marijuana legalization and also against immigration. Where do they sort out, right? And for younger people in particular, you know, I think climate change is something that they grew up with as textbook science. So as they gain political awareness, they're looking at one party that just flat out rejects the science, has no solutions, and then another party that is having an extremely robust debate about what a Green New Deal really means, and that universally accepts the science and wants to do something about climate change. We just don't know what that something is yet. So I think if that something becomes ambitious and scales and creates a future economy that's really clean, that younger generation of voters is going to not just stay with the Democratic coalition, but be really enthusiastic. And in the Sunrise Movement, they're just such smart activists. They were helping elect a lot of these Democrats in their districts. And then after the election saying, we are 100% with you. We helped get you elected. Now we really want you to prioritize climate change. And that's the reason that we're going to stick with you, because this is, you know, generational scale issue for us. And I think the party is hearing that more. I think individual members are hearing that more. And I think they're respecting the fact that, yeah, that base is what wins elections for us.
Aaron Huertas, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Budos Band, The Grateful Dead, and Van Morrison. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.